If you've missed a show, the full audio library is at RadioMD.com. And now back to you, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
And this is Dr. Mike. You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show, and I have someone I really admire as a guest coming on. Now, Laszlo Bock is author of Work Rules, Insights from Inside Google That Will Transform How You Live and Lead. It's published by 12 books. It's a really wonderful read, very interesting, fascinating, great insights. And if you like Google at all, or Google anything at all, and I don't think I know anyone who doesn't Google something. I probably use it 20 times just preparing for the show, not relating to this book. But it is it's just such fascinating stories. So, Laszlo, may I call you that?
No, of course. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you, and thank you for persisting, even though you had trouble getting on, so thank you.
Well, I'm glad I made it. Sorry about that.
Me too. Our number had changed, so I apologize. And in fact, if you're, for those people who want to ask questions, you'll have to do it via the email line, because I don't think our 800 numbers are set up yet, again, but the it is 800... I'm sorry, it is udocs, UDOCS at gmail.com, and I should say that's a Google product too. So I'm filled with Google. But anyway, Laszlo, one of the real tricks that people think you do is sort through a ton of applicants to find great employees. And you have an awful lot in the book about how you find employees, so I can't help but ask you, when we look in a physician, a group, in a physician's office, we do it somewhat on gut, somewhat on asking the questions, somewhat on seeing if they'll fit in, and always on their medical school and residency performances, which are quantitated by huge number of tests. What I got from this is that you do a different type of actual practice exam almost on employees.
Yeah, we actually have a very structured interview process. And when we were smaller, we used to actually look at where you went to school and your grades and test scores. And what we found was actually for our business, that didn't predict performance at all. It may be different in the medical profession because actually the most predictive thing is the work sample test. So how somebody performs in, for example, their residency will tell you a ton about how they actually perform as a doctor. For business, though, and for most fields, interviewing actually doesn't work that well. We make snap judgments even though we're not conscious of it, and we tend to spend the rest of the interview just trying to confirm or deny that initial hypothesis we kind of draw. And so what we look for at Google instead is we look for cognitive ability, problem solving. We look for emergent leadership. So do you step in, solve a problem, step out? We look for cultural fit, which for us is about really intellectual humility and conscientiousness rather than are you just like the rest of us? And the least important thing is do you actually know how to do the job? Because if you have these first three attributes, we figure you'll be fine in the job. You'll figure out something new. And then we use what are called structured interviews. And a structured interview is actually not too hard to design and kind of boring to talk about, but it's basically saying, once you know what you're looking for, to say, give me an example of a difficult problem you solved or when you had to emerge as a leader, and making sure everyone interviews for those same characteristics. And by doing that, you avoid the trap we tend to fall into, which is, tell me your greatest strength, greatest weakness, why this company, how'd you get here, none of which actually lets you really predict how someone will perform.
Yeah, I've been asking, it's interesting, so I've probably done, you know, if you look at it, because as a residency director, which I was for 17 plus years at the University of Chicago, I would interview, we had about 15 positions for residents, and we'd interview about 20 people for each of those 15 positions. So we would get someplace, if you will, over 600 or 700 applicants for the 15 positions, and we'd whittle it down based on grades in medical school, if you will, and performance, as well as a little bit on their letters. But I would ask the same questions, which we're trying to get at the culture of the person. That is, what values they valued in life, by asking them about their teachers and what they admired about teachers and didn't admire about teachers, and what learning style they had. So it was interesting that I did a structured interview, but not on work performance. And the go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, the structuring is what's important, because particularly in a field like medicine, but in all fields, you want people with a certain set of values. And, you know, it doesn't matter if they're Republican or Democrat, but what does matter is that they sort of have a sense of wanting to do the right thing, of service to others. And it sounds like you were getting at a lot of that.
Yeah, you can pretty well, from the teachers who they admired, you can pretty well get the values they admire. The question I had is, if their work skill doesn't matter, but you give them, don't you give them a test of work?
We do, but only for very few jobs. You know, the challenge is, for a lot of jobs, a test of work actually is really hard to put together. So, you know, we have jobs where, for example, we have folks, for example, in some of our India offices, where the job is to make sure some of the search results are high quality. And so part of that job is to look at actual search results and make a qualitative assessment that supplements all the quantitative metrics we have. So that's fairly straightforward to test for, because you show them a bunch of search results, they, as a test, will say what they think and assess them, and if their results are good, then you know you should probably hire the person. When you get into jobs that are much less structured, say an attorney or a software engineer, it's much harder to have a specific test. So what we'll do for software engineers, for example, is we'll have them do a kind of a series of coding problems that they have to work through. But again, even those are quite distinct from kind of, you know, the case interview model you see in a lot of places, because we go back to coding questions that we know actually predict performance.
Now, let me try and relate some of this to medicine. And one of the things that fascinated me when I came to the Cleveland Clinic was there's a totally different culture in the operating room here than I had ever seen anyplace else. And it totally was driven by outcomes. That is, you want the highest outcomes for your patients. Everyone knows everyone else's outcomes. It's published and pretty clear and transparent. But what is interesting is that there is no hierarchical management. That is, if a nurse screws up, the other nurses take her out behind the back door and beat the heck out of her, rather than the surgeon or someone above her doing that. So it's a peer pressure to perform. Is that similar to the environment? In other words, you talk about a non-hierarchical environment in the book.
Yeah, it's actually very, very similar. I mean, I think it's similar in that way, but it's also similar in that, you know, in the medical profession, there's this very healthy, I mean, certainly at hospitals like your own, this healthy habit of doing postmortems of, you know, after something happens, after there's a surgery, if something doesn't go well, to actually step back and try to diagnose. And actually, in our business, we've co-opted the phrase. We use postmortem, but we don't mean it quite as literally. And whenever something breaks, we sit down and try to figure out what went wrong and how to prevent it. But you're right. The core of the feedback is to have it coming from peers and actually even subordinates. So one of the things we do is we try to make sure managers have as little power and control as possible, so that the bulk of their time is actually spent helping people, and your feedback as you go along from your peers.
We'll be right back with Laszlo Bock. Work Rules, insights from inside Google that will transform how you live and lead. We'll be right back.
Don't miss a minute. Listen at your leisure, always online and on demand at RadioMD.com. You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
And we're talking to the author of Work Rules, Laszlo Bock. The book is number 106 on the Amazon bestsellers list as we speak. Hopefully you'll buy some and put it into the top 100, because this is really a great book. You should give it to friends as well. One of the things that we that is, I think, very different from GE and Google is that you do something very different with the bottom 10%, if you will. As I remember what the Jack Welch always talked about, is they rank people as, I think it was 20-70-10, and the top 20 would get promoted and get extra training, and the bottom 10 would be sent home and fired every year. You don't
yeah,
do
that's
that,
right.
do
No, we take a very different approach. You know, the problem with taking your bottom whatever percent, 10%, 15%, is that you might actually have a team that where the worst person on it is better than the best person on another team. And you get this kind of vicious dynamic where on this great team, Team A, you're kind of forcing out your very best people and losing them as a company. So it creates all kinds of messy dynamics. What we instead do at Google is we focus intensely on hiring up front and investing in making sure we're very cautious about who comes into the company. So first, we kind of think we do a good job of finding great people. We try to do the best we can. What we then do, though, is we actually do identify periodically a couple times a year the bottom 5%, but we don't link it to performance at all. So it doesn't touch your bonus. It doesn't change your odds of promotion. We actually then just reach out to you and say, can we help you get better? And because it's not tied to a direct consequence, people are much more open to learning and changing and getting better. You know, as soon as you tie it to a threat, people become defensive. They stop learning. And about a third of the time, that works. The rest of the time, we actually ask them to try a different job in the company, and 80% of the time, their performance improves dramatically. They sort of go from being bottom 5% to average performers. And you might say, well, average doesn't sound that great, but out of a group of 100 people, they're going from being the third from the bottom to number 48 or 50 or 52. It's a huge performance improvement, and it's so much better than having to fire somebody and have them leave and have to spend time searching for a replacement when you don't even know how that replacement's going to do.
So one of the keys is we like in medicine we use the analogy of Michael Jordan. You know, no matter how good Michael Jordan is, he wasn't a center. And so if we hire a great person, but they're hired for a center and they end up being a two guard, it won't work. So you've got to find another job for him.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because if you think about it, anytime you apply for a job, you actually don't know the company that well. We all do homework, but we don't actually know how we're going to fit on that team, how we're going to succeed, what exactly the job entails. And the company doesn't know us that well either. We kind of have a couple interviews, but it's not like you've worked with someone for 6 months. So once someone clears your bar, and it should be a high bar, you then need to give them a chance to actually find their way to the right job. And if it's not a good fit initially, often you're better having them find a better fit inside your company than going through the pain of exiting.
Now, you also changed the food, not the food offerings, but the food that was eaten. And tell us how you did that.
Yeah, so at Google, we offer free meals to everybody and their guests. And around our campus, in addition to cafes, we always have what we call micro kitchens. So on every floor, you know, Sergey Brin, one of our co-founders, used to always say, no one should ever be more than 150 feet away from food. Because he didn't want us hungry, but he also wanted people bumping into each other, breaking bread together. And the problem is, if you give people lots of food, they eat lots of food. And, you know, the CDC reports that 69% of Americans are overweight or obese. And we didn't want to end up in that same predicament. So what we did was we had candy and M&Ms and soda and fruit and granola bars and sort of the range of unhealthy to healthy things. And first, we tried just telling people, don't eat the bad stuff. And people said, don't interfere with my freedom to choose. I'll eat whatever I want. We then tried telling them, here's why it's bad for you. We put up signs that said, you know, if you eat a can of soda a day over a year, or if you drink a can of soda a day over a year, that's 36,000 extra calories, and that's 10 pounds you're going to gain in a year. People didn't care. They kept drinking the soda. So then what we did was we tried something called nudging, where we made it just a little bit harder to make a bad choice and a little bit easier to make a good one. We took the M&Ms, the Snickers bars, all the unhealthy stuff, and we just put them in opaque containers where you couldn't see what was inside. They were still labeled, but we made it easier to see the fresh fruit, for example. We tried this in our New York office, and the results were incredible. After 7 weeks, Googlers in our New York office, our employees in New York, ate 3.1 million fewer calories. That works out to almost 900 pounds of weight they did not gain because we made it just a little bit harder to reach for a sugary snack. And we've since rolled that out across the company.
Wow. I can't even remember how many calories less, but and you did that by just some kind of engineering feat. Now, you also went to, I remember one of the stories of a Meatless Monday.
Yeah, Meatless Monday didn't work so well. You know, one of the things, there was this movement in sort of the chef community nationally about, you know, why don't we reduce our reliance on meat? And so a bunch of restaurants and our own chefs at Google said, let's not offer meat on Mondays. So in two of our cafes in Mountain View, California, and we had about 30 cafes at the time, they said, on Mondays, we're not going to serve meat. And our employees, a set of them, the ones who went to those cafes, a good chunk of them were furious. Because they said, and, you know, let me step back and say, it's a little silly to complain about not getting, you know, the exact kind of free food that you're used to getting. It's still free food. It's still delicious. But they were upset because they said, I want to be able to choose. I can make these decisions for myself. And so we actually had fewer people going to those cafes because they voted with their feet and went to the other cafes where they could have what they wanted. And it was an important lesson for us in if you're trying to change behavior and if you want people to make better decisions, it's really rough if you just force that upon them. You have to educate them and then give them options and then structure the environment in a way that they can make better choices for themselves.
And now the... You use nudge a lot. Tell us about nudge.
So the concept of nudging was developed by two academics, Thaler and Sunstein at Chicago, University of Chicago and Harvard. And they basically had this idea, or at least put it to paper, that said, a nudge is not a shove. A nudge is a small change in an environment that encourages somebody to make a better decision. So us taking away meat on Mondays was not a nudge. That was a unilateral policy change. People didn't have a choice. Us offering, for example, smaller dishes in our cafe alongside bigger dishes was a nudge because it made it just a little bit easier to make a choice that's healthy for you. And, you know, there's research, as you know, that says if you eat off of a smaller dish, you feel more satisfied, you eat less. There was a study done at a health and fitness camp for high school students. And they gave campers cereal bowls for breakfast, say, to eat their cereal. Some campers got small ones and some large. The ones with smaller cereal bowls ate 16% less food.
Experience real energy and power like you've never dreamed possible through the powers of wild forest extracts from North American herb and spice. Wild chaga and birch bark are the secrets of the forest used by top Olympic athletes who no one could defeat. Wild chaga is the world's top source of superoxide dismutase, the critical enzyme that blocks the aging process. Chaga birch bark is good for your heart and healthy cholesterol and helps build healthy arteries. No wonder it is known as the king of all herbs. Wild birch extract is the top source of betulin, a natural sterol needed by every cell in the body. And healthy cells mean a healthy you and a more powerful you too. So take North American Herb and Spice's Chaga Charge Tea with wild birch bark and Chaga Max capsules to get the maximum energy you need. You deserve it. Available at fine health food stores and online at p73.com. That's p-73.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This is Meryl Streep. Over the years, I have played some characters you could call controlling, but the truth is, there's so much in life we can't control. But here's something we can: colorectal cancer. It affects men and women, and it's the second leading cancer killer in the U.S., which is astounding, considering it's almost entirely preventable. Here's how. Most colon cancers start as polyps, and screening helps find polyps so they can be removed before they even turn into cancer. Screening also finds this cancer early, when treatment works best. For me, screening was simple and quick. It was no big deal, except for the huge sense of relief you feel afterwards. There are several tests that you can choose from. If you're 50 or older, you should talk to your doctor. Decide which one's right for you. Take control. Do everything you can to prevent colon cancer. Screening saves lives. It could really save your life. For more information, call 1-800-CDC-INFO.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human